This sermon was recorded at the worship service of the First Congregational Church of Albany, New York, with the church's pastor, Reverend James Eaton, preaching. The church worships at 10:30 every Sunday, and everyone is welcome. We're located at 405 Quail Street in Albany, New York. For more information, go to our church website at albanyfirstcongregational.org. Thanks for listening. May you find a blessing today.
Will you pray with me and for me? Oh Lord, help us to drink from your word like thirsty people, treasuring each and every drop. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in thy sight, who alone is our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Have you ever found a treasure? Ever? Maybe your grandparents or your aunt and uncle had a house that was old and it had an attic. And you would go up there and play and find things that you hardly understood. Or maybe somebody draped costume jewelry over you one time and you got to be a princess. My grandson used to love doing that. Or maybe somebody handed you a baseball that had an old and fading name written on it and said gruffly, "Now that was a ball player." Every church meeting house has treasures. And we pass by them often without thinking about them. Look at the beautiful stained glass windows here. Think how someone coming in and seeing it for the first time may be inspired. When I go to a new church as a pastor, one of the first things I like to do is to go poking around in the closets. I remember doing that here, finding little back passages behind the stage and looking to see what we had. And what we had, it turned out, was an endless supply of stuff. There's stuff all over this place. There's a Sunday school room upstairs with more art supplies in it than they have at Staples. There's dishes in cabinets that haven't been seen in years, I think. One of the fun things about being the pastor here is whenever we need something, I can almost always find it. Yesterday, when I was looking for some special piece to mount a Unity candle for you guys, I just went down in the cabinets and I took one out. Occurs to me, I didn't even ask for permission. Now, a number of years ago, I was serving a church with a building that had gone up in 1854. 1854. That's before most of you were born. It's before Arvella was born. It's even before I was born. Now, you know how when you live in one place for a long time, stuff just magically accumulates. You don't know where it came from. But, you know, there's that old computer that you replaced that's too valuable, even though it doesn't work, to get rid of. And it's sitting in a closet somewhere or on a shelf. There's all those books. There's all kinds of stuff. You know how that goes. So imagine that your home had been there since 1854. Like this church building. It was full of closets, and they were full of treasures. But the greatest treasure of all was the Victorian silver, the silver that they had bought in the 1870s. It was rarely mentioned. It was a sort of church secret. But once in a while, someone would allude to the valuables. Now, Like most ministers, I'll do almost anything to avoid actually writing a sermon. And so one day in that church, when I was avoiding my sermon, I was walking around and poking into closets, and I had found some keys. So there was a big closet there with a lock on I'd been curious about, and I unlocked it, and there it was, the treasure, the Victorian silver. It was all in little velvet bags. And I took the box out, and I began to take each piece out of its little velvet bag and set it on the counter in the kitchen. Pretty soon, I had a whole counter full of silver and a pile of little velvet bags, and I began to worry because, like Peter Rabbit in the garden, I knew I wasn't supposed to be messing with this stuff. And if the farmer came along, I would be in trouble. So as best I could, I started putting it all back in its bags and back in the box, and I put it all back in the closet, and I locked the closet back up. And I didn't say anything about it for a long time, but those of you who know me know there was no way I was going to leave this alone. So one day at a church council meeting, I, as casually as I could, because I knew it wouldn't do to make a point of this, so very casually I said, I happen to have found the Victorian silver. And they ignored me. It's what church councils do with their ministers sometimes when the minister has said something uncomfortable. So at another council meeting a while later, I brought it up again because those of you who know me know that there's no way I was going to leave this alone. And someone finally explained to me that we couldn't use the silver because it was tarnished. And so I, knowing nothing about silver or tarnish, not realizing how many hours it would take to clean this, said, well, why don't we just clean it? And someone said, well, we don't use it, so there's no point in cleaning it. You see how this works? We don't use it, so there's no point in cleaning it, and because we don't clean it, we can't use it. It was nice, wasn't it? It was a perfect little circle. It couldn't be used because it was tarnished. Now, for those of you who don't know much about silver, let me just say that when silver just sits, it gets this little dull layer of oxide. Sometimes it turns black, and that's called tarnished. The last few days after I posted this sermon online, I have been hit with a lot of criticism for explaining this. Frankly, mostly from the women ministers on there who explained that everyone knows about tarnish. But just in case you don't, I didn't either. So don't feel bad. And once the silver was tarnished, it was unfit and worthless for use. One woman emailed me to say that she didn't understand why I was criticizing this viewpoint because everyone knew this. Sure, all the way from Scotland to tell me that. It was a tarnished treasure. Now, you and I are God's treasure. Creatures meant to reflect God's glory, but I think often just as the bright silver stops reflecting when it's tarnished, we get tarnished and think our days of reflecting God are over. We're not up to it. We're not worthy to do it. Sometimes it's something we've done or something we've been or something that we've lost or added. We may be treasure, but we're tarnished treasure. And like the silver, we assume that often a dark closet is the right place for us. I think Jesus encountered lots of tarnished treasure people. And so he tells this story that we read this morning. This shocking story. He lived in a restless, violent world where there was increasing pressure to buy up small landlords and turn small farms into big farms owned by absentee landlords. A world where unscrupulous bankers took advantage of people, and many people worked for these large farms that didn't offer health insurance, pensions, or anything else but a bare minimum wage. So restless, hungry, poor people sometimes got violent. And there were lots of instances of small peasant revolts to which the authorities would react by bringing in some soldiers and killing the peasants. So he tells this story. Some tenant farmers have been working in a vineyard. And at the end of the vineyard season, there's a harvest. And presumably they're sharecropping. And perhaps it wasn't a good year. Perhaps there isn't much profit. Who knows? At any rate, when the owner, who has done nothing, sends his servants to collect the harvest, most of it, and all of its profit, the farmers react violently. They beat the servants one after another, and finally, when he sends his son as a sign of seriousness, they kill him. Wow. What will the owner do? What will the owner do, Jesus asks. We all know the answer, don't we? We know what we do. The listeners know what the owner will do. He'll do what owners always do. He'll get the police, in this case the Romans, to come and get those murdering tenants and string them up. A life for a life, the judge will say, and justice will be done. What will the owner do? Why even ask? We all know how this ends. The world's answer to problems is violence. The tenants feel the injustice of sharecropping and see no way out except to kill the owner's son. Surely the owner will reply with the authorized violence of the police forces. Who's right? Who's wrong? Last week, I watched a moving documentary on the Vietnam War, and among its finest moments was a comment by a former North Vietnamese soldier. Now, I remember that war, and I remember the terrible grief of losing 58,000 people. The North Vietnamese lost over 3 million people. So this soldier is talking about the war, and he says at one point, who was right, who was wrong? There is no right and wrong in war. There's only death and destruction. We've all seen this deadly dance. We can imagine the people hearing Jesus tell the story. Some in the crowd are tenant farmers. Surely some come from that world. They know, perhaps they remember when an owner came and killed everyone. Others are authorities, owners, and their agents, and they're already mad. Matthew sets the story right after Jesus has overturned the tables of the money changers. What will the owner do? We all know, don't we? And in fact, Matthew, or someone, has set in Jesus' mouth the words right after the parable, answering the question. But that's not part of what Jesus said. That's not part of the original parable. I think the answer to the question is Jesus' life. Jesus is about to demonstrate the most stunning and amazing answer to his own question. In the crowd before him, there are people already plotting his death. This story is told in the days just before the crucifixion. For hundreds of years, Israel has been described as a vineyard of the Lord's. And the owner of this vineyard is God. Now, what will God do when you kill God's son? What God does is astonishing. God doesn't kill the killers. God saves them. Here's the great mystery of God's love, that when we're tarnished treasure, even the most tarnished among us, God is trying, seeking, looking for a way to love us back and acting like the treasures God made us. Maybe you don't feel worthwhile. Maybe you feel tarnished. God doesn't care what you feel. God cares for you. Because God cares, we are called to care. This church is a community of care. This week, I have been so inspired. Last week, I know that some of you were here when the Kadesh family church folks began worshiping here in our building after we do. And some of them came and shared in our worship service. Pastor Patrick offer the benediction in our service, I went down and greeted them and welcomed them. And one of the comments that came back to me was something that one of our leaders said in having talked to some of their leaders, mentioned that they were so happy and so surprised because when they'd first come to us, we embraced them. And they hadn't universally found an embrace looking at space. What a wonderful blessing this church is to so many. I was so proud because Tuesday night, the yoga group was just leaving. The Kadesh people were coming in for a prayer service. Soul Rebel Theater was rehearsing upstairs. I think another group was a group that helps heal people coming out of mental illness was meeting in a different room. All of that going on in this little space. I know that this week all of us have been held wrapped by the violence in Las Vegas. There's no way to disconnect this violence from the violent culture in which we live and the river of guns that flows through it. To the question of violence, God offers this answer, God's love. And the expression of that love is the way we use our lives and treasure to extend it. The tarnished treasure at that church did eventually come out of those little bags and back to a dinner table. A couple of years after I found it, I got tired of arguing with the church leaders about it. And I did something that's really bad practice for pastors. But I did it. We were having a Maundy Thursday communion service, and we were setting it up as a Seder. It was a full dinner. And frankly, the people who were doing it were fairly new to the church. They didn't know that we weren't supposed to use the tarnished treasure. And they were new enough to the church that they still thought I knew what I was doing. So I explained that at Seder, you're supposed to put out your very best things. And I unlocked the closet and I said, there's silver in there. That's our treasure. Let's put it out. And they did on a white tablecloth. It was still tarnished. But you know, when we turned out the lights and lit the candles, the darkness and the shadows made the tarnish fade. You didn't see it. All you saw was how that treasure, that silver, glittered, just like it was meant to do. Now, that's how it is with us. We're tarnished. God uses us anyway. We're God's treasure. What matters isn't our perfection, but our persistence. Our persistent willingness to choose love over hate, to see others as brothers and sisters, to seek to live as God's blessing. Maybe you are tarnished. God still sees you as a treasure. The choir is going to sing a song in a few minutes about a simple blessing. That's us. That's you. That's me. That's how we're meant to live, understanding that we are stewards of God's gifts, not their owners. How we are meant to live is as such stewards, giving thanks for the simple blessings which sustain our lives, in turn, becoming a simple blessing to others to give our gifts as well. The kingdom of heaven is not fulfilled by any act of violence or domination. It is fulfilled in this exchange of blessing, bearing the fruit of the Spirit. What will the owner of the vineyard do? The ultimate answer is Easter. It's resurrection. When the vineyard owner is God, the owner will look at the original purpose of the vineyard, which is to produce grapes and turn them into wine. And the owner will do whatever it takes to make sure the grapes are harvested, the wine is made, the cup of the covenant is filled until it overflows, even if it takes forgiving and reusing the tarnished tenants. Amen.